That's something new with Zoom, as they're announcing that the recording is going on. So we are now recording to the cloud. It will go up on our website along with the deck and the contents of the chat window sometime after the presentation tonight. So I will stop the share. So welcome all, and this is our June 2nd Q&A session. Alan and I just discovered that we passed 1 year of weekly Q&As sometime about a month ago. So we're now going on 13 months of weekly Q&As. So thanks all for being part of it. There's going to be a bit of a switch up tonight because of the problems that Alan has been having with his ISP and dropping his connection multiple times during Q&A. I'm going to be doing the presentation, and he is going to be doing the chat window contents and posting in links there and keeping track of things for questions and stuff like that. So I will now go and share the screen, and if I can find the right one. There we go. Okay, so let's kick it off. And so people don't have to do this. The recording is done. However, in the future, if anybody wants to shout out, remind me to start the recording. I apologize for last week's session that I ended up turning on the recording. I think about 15 minutes left in the session.
Hey Chris, remember next week to turn on the recording.
Oh, okay, thanks. Yeah, remind me a little closer to the start would be helpful. Okay, so we're going to start off with a follow-up. And last week I said that universal plug and play wasn't something that really concerned me an awful lot, whether it's enabled or disabled. And I thought that for the most part, if you have a problem with universal plug and play, it means that you already have a compromised system that is on your private side of the network. And therefore, you've got bigger problems, bigger fish to fry to fix your problems. And turns out I was wrong. I like to say that I thought I was wrong once, but I was mistaken. So first off, let's look at why universal plug and play can be something that's good. Well, a program on your network or a device on your network that needs to open access to your network from the internet in order to function properly can do so. So universal plug and play allows that program to actually go into the configuration of the router and open up whatever ports are needed in order to allow it to function properly and have connections come in from the internet. So you don't have to understand anything nasty about port forwarding on your router and how to configure it and things like that. The program can do it for you. Why universal plug and play can be bad? Well, a program on your network can open access to your network from the internet. So we just said that could be a good thing. Well, it can also be a bad thing if you don't understand what's happening, what the implications can be about that. So if you have a vulnerability that could allow attackers unintended access to your internal network and all your computers that are on the private side of the network. So if we take a look at how this looks from a diagrammatic point of view, let's take an example here. We have a network where we have the router and with the two ears going up on it. We have a NAS storage device, so network attached storage, and all the devices on your side of the network are able to access that common storage area on your network. And that's really handy to do something like that. A lot of people actually like the idea of having storage that can be shared amongst all your computers. So then say you want to use it while you're on vacation. You want to access some of the files that are on your network attached storage. Well, unfortunately, the firewall that's built into your router blocks inbound connections from the internet by default. And so you can't actually get to it while you're not on your network and you're coming in from somewhere else on the internet. So NAS turns out that this one has configuration option that allows you to access it from anywhere. And well, that sounds pretty cool. So universal plug and play in there opens up the port in the firewall. So basically it opens up that hole in your firewall and it allows that traffic to flow through from anywhere on the internet through the firewall to the router and then to the NAS storage. Now, the NAS does still require some kind of password or authentication of some sort in order to allow access from the internet. You know, they're not stupid when they design this thing that they just open it wide open to the internet and allow anybody to attach to it. So all's good. Until it turns out that there was a vulnerability that was found in the NAS firmware or software that's running on that particular device. And it allows hackers to get in to your NAS device without knowing the password or whatever authentication means is enforced by the NAS. They are able to bypass that authentication. And then they can delete all your files, or they could encrypt them with ransomware and demand heavy payment for you to get your files back. So I think maybe universal plug and play is too dangerous, because if you think about it, with universal plug and play, it's the program itself that is deciding that it will open up things in what it considers to be a secure means from the internet. And you know every program or every device that's on your network that could use universal plug and play to punch holes through your firewall. Now, you can still manually do this. And so you could, with consideration, go in and reconfigure your firewall to allow specific port forwarding if you want. And you do it in a measured fashion rather than just allowing whatever program wants to do this permission to do it. The case in point that I put up there of a NAS, this is actually a real example that happened very recently. And when you first set up the NAS device, if you just basically went through next through the configuration, it would actually allow this forwarding through your router from the internet. And you had to actually go into a manual configuration where you would tell it, no, I don't want this to actually happen. Well, if you accidentally were in a situation where you did next, and you really didn't want to access this from the internet, you didn't realize it was doing this, if you had universal plug and play enabled on your router, it would happen. If you had universal plug and play disabled on the router, then even though the NAS device would try to configure the router, it wouldn't be able to. So you can go in, manually punch those holes in the firewall using port forwarding. It's not that difficult to do. You can read up about it and do it in a measured fashion where you think it makes sense. So universal plug and play just makes it easier, and I think maybe it's too easy. And so my revised advice is to disable universal plug and play in the router. So other people may vary on their opinion on that. I think it's kind of a dangerous thing to have around, and I would rather go in and do things manually on my own behalf. Okay, that's it for that. So, Alan, take it over with basic snipping tool.
Yeah, in response to our call for people to give mini presentations, we had an offer to talk about screen capture software. But before we get to the guy that's going to do it is much older and much more wiser than I. So I thought before we got to the good stuff, I'd talk briefly about the poor cousin. And I actually use screen capture quite a bit, but because I don't use it that much, I just use the Windows snipping tool. And for those of you who aren't aware, it's in the under the start menu and Windows accessories. And when you run the snipping tool, it keeps on telling me that it's moving to a new home. It's been telling me that for, I don't know, for a long time, but as far as I know, it hasn't actually moved. It's still under the start menu in that location. So this is one of the things I do with it. If you look at the Q&A page on the PCUG website, you'll find that there's this graphic, and don't forget that the next meeting is basically next week. And that gets posted as a PNG image file. So I need to grab that from somewhere. So if you look at the slide deck right at the end, there's always this slide which tells you, you know, send us your questions and the topics you want to share, And there's the graphic. Don't forget the next Q&A is basically next week. So I'd actually like to kind of grab that from that slide. And the quick way to do it is just to hit the start menu, the start button down in the bottom left-hand corner there. Go down to Windows Accessories under the W, and you'll find Snipping Tool. But because I use it quite a bit, I've actually created a tile on the start menu. So I can just, once I open the start menu, I can just click on that tile and the snipping tool will open for me. So here we are. We've opened the snipping tool now on the PowerPoint deck. So I can just hit new. And when I hit new, it basically lets me use the mouse to outline a rectangular area. So I just draw a line around the graphic. And then basically I go to the file menu and save as, and save it as my PNG file. So it's a really quick thing to do because it loads very rapidly. And it's a trivial application, but it's quite a neat little program to use for simple things like that. But if you want something a lot more powerful, then I think Bob has the answer.
Just before we jump to that, one of the things about the snipping tool that I don't see in, I think, any other screen capture program is the ability to capture an irregularly shaped outline. So besides doing rectangles and things like that, you can just do this irregularly shaped object and save it as a PNG, and you'll have it shaped that way with transparent outside the area that you circle. So kind of neat for that.
And Micheline's just noted in the chat window that when the Windows key, Shift, and S opens up Snip, as you pointed out, apparently, Chris.
I don't remember pointing that out, but anyway.
One of those keyboard shortcuts, maybe.
Yeah. Okay, so we'll go on to pass it on to, I'm going to drive the slides for him, but we have Mr. Harris, Bob Harris, who's going to take us through a bit of a presentation on GreenShot. Take it away, Bob.
Well, thank you, Chris and Alan. So this is about GreenShot, and Mr. How I use GreenShot. And if you're a Windows user, you don't take a lot of screenshots. You might take more if you had a program like this. And this is something that I use a fair bit. I used to use it when I was working a lot. I was using it pretty much the whole day. And I find it be quite fantastic. So if you don't have a screenshot program now, I would consider you need something that you can use on a regular basis. So this is definitely a small program, lightweight as they say. It's user friendly. It's incredibly instant. I'd say it's my favorite program, and it's free for commercial and private use. So you can, whether you're a company, whatever, this is a very small program, and it's instant. It hides in the background of your computer, and it comes into lightning speed with a single key press. You just hit the print screen button, and away you go. And then thereafter, there's an amazing magnifier that will highlight, that's a rectangle image you're going to capture. And as a bonus tip, I didn't always know this, but the magnifier will give you the corners of your screen. It's a little hard to zero in, but the bonus tip is you can use your mouse and the arrow keys at the same time. So you can be very, very precise in what you want to capture. You capture the image to the exact corners you want, and you can save it to a clipboard or to a file. Now, it'll capture anything on your screen. This is an email from our wise fellow, Stuart Bruce. Whatever you see in the screen, you can capture. And I might add also, on a different note, I use this thing, GreenShot, a lot. I was doing my vaccine registration a while back. I had a couple of them, and I like to know what I signed up for. You go through all these 25 steps sometimes, and you don't know what you're really buttons you press to what you put in. So it's quite easy to configure GreenShot to dump everything instantly into a certain folder. So you can run through all the stuff you're doing one by one, and it'll dump into a certain folder, and you can load it in there. I mean, if you have an exam you're taking, your questions can all be recorded what you answered in your exam with minimal to zero work. Dump them into a certain folder. So back to Stuart stuff here. Stuart mentioned you can find these images on Pixabay, which is it's awesome. But I don't want to bother downloading and saving stuff again. So I search for Happy Dog. And when the dog's on my screen, I just copy the corners and there's my dog. I can paste that into my application, an email, whatever I'm doing. And thank you, Stuart, for that. It's very effective. And I can keep on going. So it's instant stuff. Now, even if you have no experience with graphics, I bought a new PC in the fall of last year with this Photoshop Elements, but I still prefer GreenShot. It does a whole lot of features. I can copy and paste this mug, and I can use the color picker and block parts of it out. If you don't want that exact shape, you'll be an expert instantly. And on the editor, I'd add also that there's fully features in here. You can go levels up and down for images and GreenShot, just like a Photoshop program. It's very effective. Well, too faster, Chris.
Oh, sorry.
And so this is the color picker here right now. And I use this one a lot. But this will pick color. I have two monitors on my screen here. I can pick colors from anywhere on my two monitors, not just the open window. And it's neat to have colors that you're using, not just pick a different color, because you can't get the same green or the you want. So you can find somewhere else. And anyway, you'll be an expert in seconds. Thanks, Chris. So speech bubbles again here. You can take a handsome fellow like this and in seconds put a speech bubble on the screen. And as mentioned, it's neat to try to pick the colors from within the screen if you wanted. This is a bad example of this, but on clip art and stuff, you want to pick the same colors of your font. And beyond this, there's cool websites on the internet. You can type in certain texts. One is flaming text, and the other is cool text. You put in your custom text, get free logos, free designs, and you can download those to your computer. Go ahead, Chris. Thank you. And if you want to do a happy birthday, Bob, here, you type in your custom text. These sites will give you hundreds of variations of happy birthday, Bob. You scroll through, pick the one you want. Go ahead, Chris. But there's no reason to download these. It says on here you can edit the logo, download it, save your account, go to Facebook. Well, with the GreenShot, it's already free. If I can copy it, I can see if I can copy it. You take that little graphic, happy birthday, Bob. This is what I do, how I use it. Maybe it's kind of silly, but how I use it. You copy that text, happy birthday, Bob. You can go back in there and add some more text to that. I copy that same one in the same font. And go ahead, Chris. So with GreenShot, you make your birthday cards. A bit of cardstock paper. You can truly make, I use it every year myself, and I get a birthday card from myself, and I do it myself. Anyway, the GreenShot and the free software, it's instant. Now, in GreenShot, there's a sizing preferences in here. I set mine to 100%, and there is available for PNG caliber photos. I usually use the JPEG, the JPG format at 100%, and it's fast, it's instant. And go ahead, Chris. So you see these in the file. So if you want to email a photograph, it's often too big to resize. Well, you can use EarthenView and other things to resize your photograph, but a simple screenshot at 100% is really tiny. So this screenshot was 2.3 megabytes in my phone, a screenshot with GreenShot. It could be a copy and paste or put it into your folder. It's much smaller. And it's simple to email or your website. And the quality, in my view, is 100%. So this is a cool program. So if you haven't got a screenshot tool now, this, I uninstalled mine and reinstalled it in less than 1 minute. There's no passwords. There's no reboot. You're doing it right away. And at greenshot.org. And, of course, Chris told me about this stuff years ago, but I didn't do it initially. I didn't like GreenShot initially the first time Chris mentioned it before. I went at it a few years later, many years ago, and ever since, I would say it's my favorite. So it installs quickly. It's a very light program. Any questions you got? There are folks smarter than me, and there's one right there.
Bob, you probably use it more than I do.
This is a cool program. You can install it in a minute, take it off again in a minute, too. And the features are very deep. The color picker is fantastic. And I use it a lot. I always do use it a whole lot. So I thank Chris for bringing this to our attention. There's an article, back one, Chris, please, the back one if you can. There's an article in the newsletter a while back, and it's still just as valid as it was back then. So my little overview is quite minimal, but Chris has this article that's worth, if you aren't sold on it yet, see the article by Chris, and I thank Chris for this, and I'll be quiet now.
Thank you.
Natalie has a question for one of you. She says, is this for PC and devices?
Yeah, it's Windows only.
Yeah, Windows.
As far as I know. Yeah.
Yeah.
And Stuart says he guesses he's a happy dog.
Happy dogs are always good, yes. No, it's a great program. I use it like pretty well with everything I'm doing. I always have something I want to capture, and it's a great program.
Yeah, I can attest to the fact that certainly amongst the free screen capture programs, it's certainly one of the most capable that's out there. It's very, very good. I do love the option that they have of using the keyboard to be able to, when you're dragging out your area, that you can actually use the keyboard to fine-tune exactly the area that you're capturing, and that magnified view that lets you zoom in right to the pixel level. What it is you're going to capture. So really, really nice program. If you don't have something quite capable right now, I highly recommend you try it out. It's free. If you don't like it, you can uninstall it.
And I can add one more thing. This article, this little screen right here, if you wanted to take a GreenShot of that and say you didn't like the green, I enjoy using GreenShot. If you didn't want to have that in there, take the whole GreenShot and take a simple line and put your little line through that, and then use your eyedropper to make the line you put over that into the same color as the background, and any text you want on there is gone in an instant just by putting the same background color over you or top of that, and the layers are all there too. So I can pretty well hack any graphic watermarks, and I wouldn't say that, of course, but
okay, thanks a lot, Bob.
Pretty good. Thank you all.
That was a great, great overview of GreenShot.
Yeah, Bob Walker here. Just one question. Can it do video capture as well, or is it just image capture?
No. Sorry, it's off right there. There's no video capture at all.
Yeah, strictly a graphic.
Yes.
Of the, yeah, single graphic. Okay, I don't see any other questions in the chat, so I guess we'll go on. And we had a question come up, are Square payments secure? And I think this was it Natalie? That
yeah, I believe so, yeah.
Yeah. So the question came in saying that some vendors at a farmer's market were using Square in order to allow for payments. and she received an email message with confirmation, and she is guessing that it uses the email address that is on file with the credit card company. And then the more she thought about it, the more she questioned about the security. Is this a secure app or not? She read some things online. Still not sure if payments through Square are secure or not. So I guess the question goes out to the audience here. Does anybody else have experience with using Square? And do you have any opinions on whether there should be concerns about using it? Or does anybody know for sure exactly how that email confirmation got through? Anything at all. So people could unmute themselves to respond or throw it into the chat window.
And I checked with Natalie. That email, it wasn't that the vendor asked whether she wanted an email receipt or not. It just arrived.
Yeah, it's not an option. So basically the vendor, all he did was, I guess, put the amount in and then gave me this, like, I mean, it looks like just a Square screen. There's no printed receipt. There's nothing. And he said, I'll get an email. And I said, well, you know, I didn't give you any information. He said, no, it's in there. I don't think he really understood what was going on. And so there was no option for me to give information or do anything. It was just automatically generated.
Did he bring up a QR code and you scanned the QR code or?
No. Literally just put in the amount
credit
I owed
card,
him.
That was it.
Gave me the machine. I tapped my card and that was it. And I said, wow. What receipt? And he said, it'll be emailed to you. And I thought, what is going on?
Excuse me. I think I've seen these devices at Staples, so where anyone can pick them up and use them for transactions. I may be wrong.
Well, presumably they would have to sign up with a card processing company, right?
Yeah, well, the credit cards know everything.
Yeah, the basic process is the Square is a device that plugs into the vendor's cell phone. And you swipe your card through a slot in it, and it picks up your card information and nominally goes through the vendor's pay processing company, which is probably their card company. The big thing you have to know about security is, does your credit card company guarantee these transactions? If you do a transaction through Square using your, let's say, your TD card, will TD guarantee it if something goes wrong? And that's where the security comes in. If your credit card company basically says, hey, if you buy something through a Square device and something goes wrong, don't complain to us, then that's where you can get your security or not get your security. And it's up to you what your risk aversion is.
I wonder if it's quite so cut and dried as that, though, Bob, because my understanding is that your liability limit on credit cards, period, is something like $50. So I don't think that they can hold you liable beyond that if it's fraud.
Yeah. Canadian financial companies are so anal retentive that it's hard for fraud to – it's hard for people to be scammed through a credit card.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that was my understanding with credit cards is your liability is quite limited. If you claim fraud, it's like $50 or whatever.
And as I said, I think I saw these devices on sale, maybe not Staples, but somewhere in a retail store where anybody can buy one and use it for transactions. So it's I'd have to look it up, but it shouldn't be that hard to research.
Yeah, but again, they're going to have to sign up with a payment processor And I think that's where, you know, basically they end up signing off on, you know, they're accepting liability to a certain extent too, that if people claim fraud, the payment processing company is going to come back to them. I
wonder if Square themselves are the payment processor.
Could be.
Because on their website, they're selling point-of-sale terminals, as Stuart mentioned.
Yeah.
You can buy the terminal, and it says that the transactions are secure. The good news is, if you look on the web, there's nothing bad that anybody says about Square. The bad news is, all the good things that are said are on the Square website.
Exactly. That's why I didn't really trust what was out there.
Yeah. One of the other things that's always concerned me about credit card payments, too, is that although your liability is limited that way, I have heard of people that they think they're buying one thing, and then it turns out they're buying a, you know, weekly shipment or something like that. Mm. And because the vendor will claim, well, there's no fraud. I mean, the person said they wanted this weekly, and it's really, really hard to get them to actually stop. And the credit card company says, well, you signed up for a weekly thing. You have to go and, you know, get the company to stop this transaction because you authorized it. So they're not really interested in trying to stop things. And I've heard of people who say that the only recourse they ended up with was to cancel their credit card. And so they had to pay off whatever was due at that point in time. But that was the only way to end the onslaught.
You know, I'm trying to remember how many cassette tapes I bought back in the 70s. Columbia House with that never-ending subscription.
Yeah, right.
Well, Gowan has an interesting comment in the chat window. He says initially the device was free. So that suggests to me that they were giving away the point-of-sale terminal, but they were making their money on the transaction.
Yeah, I think you're right.
So they probably are the processor.
Right.
Well, typically, if you're a vendor like a store or a merchant or a vendor at a flea market or whatever, the credit card company takes anywhere from 3 to several % off the top of the transaction. So, even you're paying the vendor, let's say $10, they might only see less than $9 out of that in their own pocket after all is said and done.
Yeah.
The credit card companies in between are making all the money.
And that's true, Bob. The Square, I think their transaction fee is 2.95%.
It sounds suspiciously like there's a cap of 3 or something.
2.99 this week only.
Yeah. Okay.
I've got a question for
you, Nat. But.
Yeah. I just had a question for Natalie that are you finding that the farmers markets won't accept cash anymore because of COVID? Because that's the only place I use my cash I did last year. Was it just your preference?
No, I've been to, so I was at the main market and I was at the Orleans market. And so it really depends on the vendor. And so some of them, like I know the main market, there's online purchases and then you just get an order number and you pick up. Or now that it's weekly, you can go and some of them take cards, some of them take cash, some of them take both. It really depends on the vendor.
Okay.
I'm finding it's really a mixed bag right now.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, well, I think we've covered that off as well as we're going to this evening. So I think we'll carry on. Nat, if you hear anything more that you can share with us in the future, on this topic, by all means, fire it into suggestion box at opcug.ca, and we'll do a follow-up on it.
I might actually speak to one of the farmers next time and ask.
Yeah, that'd be interesting. Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, I have a quick share on using Microsoft OneDrive. We've had some questions in the past about various cloud storage services that are out there. And I personally use Google Drive, and I'm quite happy with it. And I found that Microsoft OneDrive, which is Microsoft's cloud storage, there were some sort of confusing options about it. And it's not the most straightforward service to use, but it is quite a capable service. And sure enough, Kevin Stratford, my favorite person on YouTube on how to use things technology related, he has a video on how to use OneDrive. And so if you're thinking about it or you are using OneDrive and you want to know a little bit more about the different ways it can be configured, the URL on the screen will get you to his, I think it's about a 5-minute video on what you can do with Microsoft OneDrive. So take advantage of that if you're so inclined. Okay, the next one we have is a share from Orion. Orion, you can unmute yourself if you want to walk it through. If you want, you could share the slides from your side, or I can drive the slides and you could just speak to them. So if you wanted to unmute yourself.
I'll let you drive them.
Okay, great. Go ahead, and if I'm lagging, just yell at me to advance the slide.
I kind of stumbled across this topic because of the fact that Educators Financial Group indicated that your will should have all the digital assets that are important to you mentioned in your will. So when we say what happens to accounts and then an incapacity and death, we should also think about what ones you want to control, because it appears that a lot of digital assets are controlled by the terms of the agreement that you signed on to in order to set up the account in the first place. So something that most of us don't bother reading, we just accept it and on we go. But very definitely for the executor of a state, it would be an ideal if you had all your accounts controlled in password keeper. But that's another item. We'll move on to the next one here. So one thing I have mentioned is that whatever you put in here as a codicil in your will, make sure that you don't put any passwords in, because don't forget, wills are public documents, and so you don't want access to any passwords in there. But the task is quite insurmountable, because are we going to judge what you want to put in? And what has already been taken out of your hands is a difficult task. Certainly want access to all your photos. You want access to all of your memberships that you have, and certainly your email streaming services. You can always cancel your subscription. The same with all your home services. You can cancel too, but when it comes down to things like your social media accounts, that becomes more of a problem. Next, please. So I've just indicated a few comments for a number of accounts here, and most of my information has come from PC Magazine, so I assume it's fairly accurate. But one thing I will mention to you, if you want to test some of this information out, please remember that things are constantly changing. So what is there now? So when I started doing research and started looking at postings on Google from 2006, 2008, they didn't agree with what was being now posted in 2015 and later. So things are constantly changing. So at the very end, the last slide, you'll notice that there's two slides, one on Facebook and one on Google, which tell you how you could have your account set up so it'd delete after death. This might be the simplest way to handle both of those accounts. Next, please. So again, I've just indicated something like Google is no end to the number. I've just indicated a few things which could be controlled, and also the fact that YouTube couldn't be held deleted separately from the rest of your Google accounts. And I don't know how many people use Google Plus. I don't, but I could put that in as another comment. Again, please. And the same with Microsoft. One thing that I have a very poor understanding is where my cursor is here. If you have a Windows device with reset protection enabled, it indicates that it could affect your actual telephone account. That part I'm not sure how to explain, because I don't fully understand it. Process of Microsoft can take quite a while in order to set it up. And next, please. So again, accounts which are involving a subscription are very easy to handle, and you just simply get rid of it, and or you can have set up an account whereby it will automatically get rid of it. Yes, that's right. You can memorialize. There is a number of variations that do occur. And our last one is simply telling you a number of sources that I use for finding the actual information. So my task or challenge issue is to try and put together a directory of how to handle a number of accounts, and it all depends on just simply research. So if you have a particular account that you like to know in advance how to set it up, I would appreciate if you would share that information with the group. And as I said, here's a ladder or two where you can set up after death. One thing that you can do, I found out that you can find ways to set up an actual account to personalize it so that the information there is quite limited, and it will simply be applied over a period of time. And here I've just indicated the things which I've made up ways to, because I found four accounts so far that I couldn't possibly remove. So I thought, well, if you want to minimize the actual risk, you can follow a few suggestions here. And then I've indicated account colors at the end. So I don't pretend to know very much about this process, but I do know that up until recently, all I had to account for would be closing down bank accounts, but a number of situations have occurred in terms of the information on the internet, which told me that no, you have to present information in your will, which allows you then to have your executor carry through on the closing of the account. Otherwise, if it's not in the will and it's valuable and it's been tied up with the terms of agreement of that particular account, you may have difficulty taking control of it as an executor. So it's a matter of trying to figure out what accounts you have to put in your will as a digital asset in order to take control of them. Otherwise, you might find the terms of agreement has prevented you from closing down the account.
Okay. Ryan, thank you very, very much for bringing this forward and doing some of the research on it, on certainly some of the major account types. I think personally the recommendation of having a password keeper is a really good idea, and giving access to that or the password to get into your password keeper, giving that to a trusted source such as your executor or perhaps your power of attorney. And I used to question a little bit about who do you trust enough with all of your online accounts, because that's essentially what you're giving access to them if you give them access to your password keeper. Now, the first part is they have to actually be able to get access to your password keeper. So just having the password to get into it is not going to be enough. They have to have physical access to it as well. So make sure that they can get logged onto your computer where the file actually will be. But in terms of the trust aspect of it, I always figure that if you provide it to the power of attorney, you've already given them access that they can basically rip you off and take all your money. That's what you've actually given them with power of attorney. So if you trust them enough with that, then perhaps you trust them enough to take care of your accounts in the case of incapacity or death. Certainly different rules can kick in upon death, for sure, that it ends up going over to the executor as opposed to power of attorney. But you have an awful lot of things that don't really matter from an executor point of view necessarily, such as your Facebook account. You know, it's really your bank accounts and things like that that the will and the executor really need to deal with for sure. So I recommend that in your password keeper, you actually have a README or exclamation mark README so that it sorts to the top that includes all the instructions of what you would like the person to take care of in the event of incapacity or death. So incapacity might be, please make sure the following bills are paid every month. In the event of death, it could be something like, please close these accounts. Please post the last goodbye to all my followers on Facebook or whatever it is that you want them to do. And then let them take care of going in and doing whatever they can to delete accounts you want deleted or whatever needs to be done on those accounts. So I think this is a really, really good topic that Orion has brought forward. And I think everybody should pay attention to that. Another thing is, besides the idea of what you want done with your accounts, if you are power of attorney for somebody else or an executor for somebody else, maybe you want to talk to them, you know, before they're in a position of incapacity or death, and ask them, what do they want done with their online accounts? And do they want to give you access so that you can delete the accounts afterwards or pay bills afterwards or whatever needs to be done? So talk to the people before it gets into an awkward position where you need access and you don't have it.
Your comments in the chat, Chris and Orion. Natalie says, a good reminder to delete accounts that you aren't currently using to simplify things in future.
Yeah, not a bad idea to clean things up.
Jocelyn made a note that if Facebook is made aware that somebody has passed away, it's the policy to memorialize the account. And he's left a link there to Facebook talking about that. And I added a comment, and I had a Google Plus account, and I think you'll find that that was Google Plus was discontinued about 2 years ago.
Yeah.
I just looked on the web, and it says April the 2nd, 2019.
Okay, do we have any other comments or questions before we move on? Alrighty then. Thanks again, Ryan. Much appreciated the contribution to Q&A. Oh, and there was, sorry, there was one more slide. Sorry, I forgot about that one. Yeah, so, yeah, Ryan has found that some accounts, it looks like, can't be deleted, which is kind of bizarre to think, oh, you set up an account and then you can't delete it. And then, yeah, some of the digital accounts, especially bank accounts and credit cards, they are really tricky to get rid of without, you know, going through the official process. Almost always you're going to have a copy of the death certificate. And that advice of getting written confirmation that the account has been closed is not a bad idea. And keep in mind that the estate has to pay any last bills and things like that. The other thing that I had advice on was credit bureaus. It's always a good idea if you're an executor that you contact the credit bureaus and inform them of somebody's passing so that there's no fraud that continues on in their name, you know, after they've passed on. And there are a couple of credit bureaus in Canada that you can send a registered letter to and get them to take care of closing out things.
Another note there, Chris, on that slide, WordPress.com accounts can, in fact, be deleted. The details are kind of hidden. It's in the settings, but you have to dig down in order to find out how to do it. And once you delete the URL, the address, you can never reuse it. So I've actually done that with kind of temporary sites I've been working on, and then I've deleted them later on. So you can delete it. You just have to check on the web how to actually go about it.
Okay. Eldon had a comment. One of the things that can happen upon death is a bank can and often will lock accounts. Can complicate any attempt to continue paying bills out of the account. My personal experience with that, when my dad passed away with, I guess it was Royal bank he was with, is that it's not an issue. What they do is they do basically transfer all of the funds into an executor account. And if you want bills to be paid, you just bring the bill into the bank, and they will actually take care of paying the bill until, you know, accounts get closed out and things like that. So it's not like the money is totally frozen. They understand the idea that bills need to be paid, and they will pay it out of the estate account. So that's been my experience. I don't know. Excuse me. I don't know if it differs. Tom mentions joint accounts stay accessible.
It's also best not to die.
Yeah, that's not a bad idea. Yeah.
And presumably they stay accessible to the survivor.
Yeah. Okay. So we've come to the end of the prepared deck. So are there any other questions or comments or shares that people have before we wrap up this evening's?
Well, it's a joint account. So if you smoke dope with them, doesn't that count?
So there were a couple of questions really early on. Michelle noted that National Capital Freenet is working on cable as well as DSL, but she can't find anything about it on their website. Has anybody seen confirmation of cable? And I've just seen the fact that they're working on it, so I guess it's a work in progress, unless anybody knows differently.
I presume as soon as they have the required agreements in place, it'll be available as a product for sale on their site.
And Tom is saying that his Caritel ISP has increased the price for 25 megabits per second to $50 over DSL. Does anybody have a better deal?
Anybody got better than that for a different provider?
You know,
25 megabit down?
You know, all I need is 25 megabits because that's enough for a 4K stream, and I live alone, so I'm not likely to watch two 4K streams.
I don't think you're going to get Rogers because I think they only offer 150 megabits.
For Rogers?
I think so.
That's on cable side, first off, rather than DSL, but they definitely do offer better than that. You can actually buy gigabit service through them.
No, but he only wants 25 gigabits.
Oh, I see, in terms of getting it that low. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And I think Bell's the same. I think Bell is 50 gig.
Yeah. I ended up bundling, with TechSavvy for internet. I had a Bell landline, and I had Rogers TV. And I decided I added it all up, and I was paying a fair amount. I guess it was close to $150 a month for the three of them. And I decided to go with Rogers for all of it. And so they had 150 megabit per second down, 15 up. They threw in a free landline. They just say, you know, if you do the bundle, we just throw it in at no extra charge. And I got, you know, somewhat their basic TV package, but it was more channels than I needed. And I think I'm paying about a little under 120 a month now, all in taxes and everything, I believe, is what I'm paying now. And I'm actually getting typically over 500 megabit down, even though I'm only paying for 150 down. I found that it is often with very large files. If I want to copy a file from, you know, my spinning hard drive over to my SSD or vice versa, it's actually faster to download it again than to copy it from one drive to another on my system. So 500 megabit is really, really nice service to have. Mm-hmm. I don't see anything in the chat, but is there anybody who wants to unmute themselves? If you have a better deal than that for $50 a month, to get at least 25. I guess, Tom, you wouldn't object to having more bandwidth than that, but your aim is to keep it under $50.
Excuse me. Didn't he say he wanted it on DSL?
Yeah.
Not cable.
Yeah.
Well,
actually, National Capital Freenet, what's their pricing on? Because they have, you know, their primary service is DSL. And I'm sure they must be offering 25 megabit. I would check out the pricing at National Capital Freenet, because I bet it's less than that.
Yeah. Does Rick here? Can you hear me?
Yep.
Yeah. I was, when I moved from Aylmer to Ottawa, I was with a company called B2B2C.ca in Montreal with DSL. And their prices were pretty good. I don't know what they are now, but you can check those out. B2B2C.ca.
Okay. Anybody else got good pricing?
The average is $56 for 25.
Really? Wow, I'm surprised they're that expensive.
Well, should well, out in the country here, because $50 doesn't get you much of anything. I'm paying $100 to get some fairly decent internet service, and I could pay more for faster speeds, but.
Wow. Well, sounds like, Tom, there's nobody jumping forward with super deals that they get currently, so I guess you could keep hunting.
You know, just increased because of the CRTC not requiring lower prices from the majors to the resellers. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So thank you very much.
Yep.
May I say something?
Sure.
Okay, this is Michelle. I'm using for my internet, and they also have for TV. I'm using TechSavvy. It is a Canadian company, a local company. And the prices were good, and they were, I know, fighting for to get a, I received a survey for, because they were fighting to get the prices against Rogers and Bell, because this is a smaller company, and so if the CRTC regulates, then they will have to put a higher price. But I mean, they are really good. So it's called TechSavvy, and you can check it on the internet. And the head office is in Montreal, I think. TechSavvy.
Yeah, they did. I was with them before, and Alan is with them now. And
okay,
part of the reasons why I switched was because they were upping the prices in anticipation of having to pay more to Bell and that. So, but yeah, I mean, it's the prices do vary around the place, and they do change. So.
And the bad news for Tom is that 25 gig DSL or 30 gig cable are both $59.95.
Yeah. Megabit, not gigabit.
Sorry, megabit, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Yeah.
So it sounds like everybody wants, like, getting up around the $60 mark for internet service.
So Jocelyn says the CRTC said that they made an error about the internet rate. Does anybody know what the error was? I think the error was, Jocelyn, they wanted to take it down and Bell wanted them to keep it up.
Yeah, I think that's the case. Okay, I
think the head of the CRTC is about to retire soon. And he's going to a position at Bell, so.
Well, the guy who is the head of the CRTC now, he does come from the industry. And so, yeah, Michael Geist has lots of stuff about that on his website. If you look at Michael Geist's blog, he's been fighting tooth and nail about the new Bill C-10 that is going to affect us in terms of privacy and content that we can post to the internet, and the CRTC having the rights to decide, no, we don't want you to share that. Anyhow, take a look at Michael Geist's blog if you're interested on that.
Tom, the good news is Allison says she's with Primus, and she just looked it up, and they're saying 25 meg for $45.95.
So you can save $4 by switching.
What's the name of that? Fibrous. Oh, it's in the...
Primus.
Primus. Primus. Oh, okay. Hmm.
Yeah, this is Justin. There is an office of TechSavvy in Gadsden also, for those who are interested, on Montcalm Street. And if I'm not mistaken, that CRPC guy, the president, is coming from Primus also.
I think TechSavvy's head office is in Chatham, Ontario.
Yeah. Okay, we are at 8:30, so let's wrap it up, I guess, at this. And just a reminder that next Monday, if you're interested, we have our own very own Lawrence Patterson is going to be giving a presentation at the Ottawa Public Library's Tech Cafe on reducing the anxiety of managing your passwords using password phrasing. So it's at 4 p.m. Next Monday. And you do have to register through the library because they use Eventbrite, and you will get a unique link sent to you if you register for it in order to be able to attend that session. And then our next monthly meeting, regular monthly meeting, is going to be next Wednesday, June 9th, and it's going to be the Origins of EdTech. We're having somebody come in from Miami, the CEO of the One Laptop Child Project. And if you look at their website, they have a lot of very fascinating information about providing education technology to mostly third world nations and ensuring that kids everywhere get access to technology. So I think that's going to be a very, very interesting program. So hopefully everybody will show up for that. And we will have the Q&A following the presentation by Mariana. So the queue is empty again, and so if you wanted to send in your questions, answers, topics, anything like that, into suggestion box at opcug.ca, and we will start up the deck for next week. And with that, we are done. So I will stop the share. So I'd like to thank everybody for coming, and wouldn't you know it, Alan, your connection stayed stable through the whole thing. So it turns out you probably could have done the share. Okay, thanks all for showing up, and we will see you next week.
Thanks, Chris.
Okay, good night all.
Yeah, thanks, everybody. Good